Anyway, we move on. One game, one community. That's the message from the Kick It Out week of action, which starts today. The anti-racism campaign's about bringing football together. Tonight, I'm joined in the studio by a man who wants to bring the story of one particular black football pioneer to the big screen. Walter Tull, a Tottenham player, a soldier, and a man whose story deserves a much wider audience than it's enjoyed so far. Author Phil Vasily is behind the project, and I'm delighted to say that Phil joins me now in the studio. Evening, Phil. Thanks for finding time to come in, mate.
Pleasure. Pleasure, Steve.
I don't know if you ever listened to my show before.
Once or twice.
Yeah, we do a lot of ranting.
But for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's about most... Between the two of us, that's about what most people can take, apart from the diehard. No, but let's get very serious now, Phil, because this guy, Walter Tull, I'm going to let you tell the story about who he is. I'm not going to ask you questions that I've got scripted here. Who is Walter Tull, or who was Walter Tull?
Well, Walter was a very special guy, but I don't think he didn't set out... I don't think he had a great aspirations to be a war hero or a great footballer. I think he was born in Folkestone in 1888. His father was from Barbados and his mother was English. And I think he had a happy family life for the first 9 years of his life until his mother died.
Died of cancer, yeah.
Yeah, and then a couple of years later his dad died and there were 6 children in the family and a young stepmother. And I think basically to keep the rest of the family together, Walter and his brother had to go in an orphanage in Bethnal Green, which was 70 miles
in
away.
Bonner Road. Now, yeah. I know people that live in Bonner Road. The family, a big boxing family, lived there. So I actually know people that live there. So he ends up having had this fairly nice 8 or 9, 10 years of his life. He now ends up in an orphanage, 2 black kids in the East End of London. And that's when he starts playing football. This is, what, the 1890s now, isn't it?
Yeah, we're talking about right the turn of the century, really. He went into the orphanage in 1898. And by the age of 14, there's a photo of him in the orphanage football team. And I think shortly after that, he started getting noticed. And Clapton was the first club. They were a big amateur club at the time. The season he joined them, they won the Amateur Cup, the London County Cup, and the London Amateur Cup. So they were like the biggest...
And that meant a lot then.
It did. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't such a great difference between amateur football and professional football as there is today, you know. So, and in the same season, he got signed by Spurs, and his first game for the Spurs first team was in Argentina.
I saw that. This is 1909. He goes on a tour of Argentina and Uruguay. When as a 20-year-old orphan, black kid flying all the way, or not flying, turned by boat all the way down there. I mean, it's a completely crazy story.
When he wrote from the boat, there's a surviving letter saying, "I'm feeling sick. I don't know if I like this journey." And, you know, I mean, it's a bit surreal now when you think about it. But then obviously the rules are a bit different and the way of the South Americans' play was a bit different, so it was quite a harsh introduction to top level football.
No, he's
really
playing for Tottenham, and he's on this boat going down to South America, Argentina and Uruguay. How many other black players were there in English football at that stage, or was he the first guy? Was he the first black player?
No, he wasn't. There was surprising to find that there were obviously nothing like today, but for the time that we could say that were at least 9 or 10 other black players.
And what would they have been, of West Indian origin or of African slave origin?
There were some black British players that were born in Britain of Caribbean parents. There were players that were born in West Africa. There were players that were born in North Africa and Egypt. But Walter was the first outfield player in the first division at the top level. There'd been another... Arthur Wharton had played at the top level, and Andrew Watson, who played for Scotland, captain Scotland in 1881, he played at the top level. And there's actually another player that's just been uncovered called Robert Walker that played in the 1870s as well for Queen's Park in Scotland. So Britain was a cosmopolitan place, and London was a very cosmopolitan place.
Still is.
Wasn't unusual, I don't think.
Now, I've got a little bit of a quote here before we sort of move on. He's positioning the teams a bit strange. It seems to me that perhaps he was being overlooked. But he plays down in Bristol against Bristol City on the 9th of October 1909. And there were some rather cowardly attacks on him. And one of the press reports, in a report from the Football Star, headlined its match report, "Football and the Colour Prejudice," describing how a, quote, "section of the spectators made a cowardly attack upon him," i.e. our man Walter, "in language lower than Billingsgate."
I think that was a slur on a Billingsgate
supporter. That's outrageous. And then he goes on to say, "let me tell these Bristol hooligans," and hooligan was a word that had only been around about 12 or 15 years at that stage, "let me tell these Bristol hooligans that Tull is so clean in mind and method as to be a model for all white men who play football, whether they be amateur or professional." Fantastic stuff.
That is incredible for its time, because that was the first report of football that I can find any reference to racism. And it was headlined. I mean, headlined to racism. At that time, in the Victorian period, they would sweep these things under the carpet usually. But I think
this is full on, isn't it?
There is, definitely, yeah.
Well, Phil's going to stay with us to talk a bit more about Walter Tull, but he's not the only one interested in the life and times of the pioneering footballer and soldier. There's more about his soldiering and his death that'll be coming up in a moment. Now, earlier this year, a group of 14 and 15-year-old history students from Henry Compton School in Fulham travelled to France and Belgium to visit the battlefield where he died. Well, I've given that away now, haven't I? Now, Jonathan Beck went to speak to Sami Bilal and Salim Maz. Apologies if either of those pronunciations were incorrect. Two of the children who made the trip, and the school's head of history, Dan Linden, about their voyage of discovery.
The trip came about because I was able to go onto ITV's Fortune Million Pound Giveaway programme and successfully bid for £9,000 to take 40 of our students to the battlefields for a three-day trip to France and Belgium.
I looked up to Walter Tull as a role model for me. He was a very heroic man. He was the first black officer coming from a tough background. I don't think he knew his mum that well. He was a professional footballer, and he got a lot of racism because he was the first outfield black player. So he's a good role model for me.
In a way, I look up to him. It's something that shows the true bravery to take racism out of massive football grounds, and he still carried on playing in the league. And also just to visit a place where he fought for the world we live in now, it's just a different feeling.
When we look at the footballing experience, the fact that he faces abuse when he was playing down at Bristol, and Tottenham, the team he was playing for, couldn't really know how to deal with it. That was an interesting issue which came out of it. And yet he ended up somewhere like Northampton, where you would have thought it would have been more difficult in Northampton, which is less multicultural than London. But he was obviously very, very happy there, and it was a very successful time for him. So it's interesting that it challenges our kind of ideas about what Britain was like at the turn of the century. It's not as clear-cut as it may have seemed.
Is it quite a weird concept that, if war broke out across Europe, every team in the country may have to give up their players to go and fight?
Now, it wouldn't be something unusual, because you see they're big football players. They don't have to do all the dirty work, because you see, like, when they do something bad, they always get let off the hook. Thierry Henry going fighting for France. So I don't think it would really work.
I couldn't really imagine it happening over here. For someone like Cesc Fabregas going to fight for Spain, and the lesser players having to argue their case whether to fight or play.
There's a lot of criticism, it seems, of football itself for going on during the war and almost bribing potential conscripted soldiers, if you like. But he broke the mould, didn't he? He was involved right from the start of the war, almost.
As far as I know, he was the first of his teammates to actually sign up for the war. He was very patriotic, he was very committed, and he saw it as his kind of Christian duty to fight for the country. What I also found interesting is this whole footballing battalion. That you've got the Middlesex Regiment, where you've got, I think, up to 2,000 professional or amateur footballers playing together. We certainly wouldn't have that today.
What kind of characteristics do you think you'd like to bring to yourself that he had?
Bravery, courageousness, loyalty.
Tenacity, influence. Basically, the main thing to make your people go along with you. If you're at the front line, the main thing is for the people behind you to feel confident in you, so they can move along with you. That's the main thing, to move as a unit.
I think probably the most moving experience we had was when we went to the actual place where Walter Tull died. And what we did was that we lined up the boys all along the side of this effectively empty field. They were all had a cross or a crescent or a plaque which they could write a few words for Walter Tull. We had a minute's silence, and it was very, very powerful, very moving experience. The boys took it incredibly seriously, and it just said a lot about the kind of impact that looking at these stories of individuals can make on pupils today, even though the event was, you know, 90 years ago.
If I was playing a football match, I'd definitely want him on the team, and therefore, like, he deserves more than just the statue. He deserves a lot more things, like a charity or a hospital named after him.
He definitely needs to be remembered. He needs to be seen as a role model for many years to come.
It was an absolutely life-changing experience, and the boys have not stopped talking about it ever since. We're going to do the same trip again next year, so it's been an incredibly successful thing.
That was an extremely enlightened history teacher called Dan Linden from, let me get this, let me find the school, Henry Compton School in Fulham. And what he did is he took a group of boys to the field where Walter Tull died. We'll be talking about his death as an officer in the First World War, Battle of the Somme, I believe. And that was Sammy and Salim talking there, and talking brilliantly, it has to be said. Now, I'm not sure for certain, but I'm hoping all of that will be available later on as a listen again, because they should play that at assembly in school one day next week. Fantastic. Phil, you're still with me. Phil, you're looking to Phil Vasili, author's with me. You're looking to try and turn this into a film. But before we move on to the nuts and bolts of trying to turn this from a great story into a great film, how did his football career, how did Walter's football career end?
It didn't end sadly. It got interrupted by the war, obviously.
Sure.
And he joined the Footballers' Battalion, mm-hmm, in 1914. Yeah, he guested a few times for Fulham while he was training at White City. The Footballers' Battalion in 1915 were based at White City, so he guested for Fulham for a few games.
Okay.
And then late 1915, he got transferred to France, and that began his kind of war career. But during the war, Walter signed for Rangers and was going to play for Glasgow Rangers.
Right?
Yeah, because
his older brother was
a dentist. That's right, yeah. And I think his brother was golfing friends with one of the Rangers players called Jazz Bowie, who later became
president.
Nothing
changes, does it? Nothing changes, eh? Tell me, Phil, any living relatives in any way, shape or form still around, still alive?
Well, there's two branches of the Tull family. Cool. Walter never had any children because he was never married, but his brother had a daughter called Jean. Now, all her family live up in Scotland, both in Edinburgh and in the Inverness area. And his other brother, William, had children, and they all live down in the Maidstone, Kent area,
okay,
in Dover area.
So still some around?
Yeah, yeah, two branches of the family still around.
Stay with me, Phil, because what we did earlier on is I came in during Eddie Nestor's Drive programme at 6:30 and just gave people a tease about what was going on. And I said that we'll be talking to a guy trying to bring the story of Walter Tull to the big screen and basically raise the profile of this great British sporting hero. And we've got a caller, and it was Steve Jenkins, who's the deputy chair of the Leighton Orient Supporters Club. Steve, are you there, mate?
I'm there, Steve. Good to speak with you again, mate.
Yeah, likewise, my friend. Steve-O, now, what's your Walter Tull story? Because it just shows you the power of radio, my friend. Tell me your story.
Well, it's the story of the Footballers' Battalion in general. I spent 6 years researching the story, particularly from Clapton Orient's point of view. They were the first football league club to join up en masse into the Footballers' Battalion.
Okay.
41 of them, players, staff and eventually supporters, all joined up.
From Clapton, yeah?
Clapton Orient, now
yeah,
Leighton Orient.
Yeah, of course, yeah, it was one of the, you know...
Yeah, the original name of the club.
That's right, yep.
And 10 players actually joined up at the meeting at Fulham Town Hall on December 1914. There was a special meeting held by the FA to get the interest going with the footballers and sway public opinion.
What
to say
a
that,
cracking story.
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that's been waiting to be told for years. I'm really glad Phil's got to grasp from the Walter Tull point of view, because I include my background to Walter in my book, and you know, the interest shown here, it sparked such a tremendous snowball of interest, not only at Orient, but with football in general now, mainly at the lower levels, I may add.
Sure.
And I took 120 people over last year, mostly Orient supporters, but a lot from the British Legion as well at Leighton and Forest Gate, over to the Orient War Graves last year, and such was the interest and reaction shown by the people that went, that we're going back next year.
What is a specific Clapton Orient War Graves memorial site?
There's three Orient footballers buried over there, got killed during the Battle of the Somme, one of which was Richard McFadden. Again, another film that should be made, including him in the story, maybe with Walter Toll. He saved a boy from drowning in the River Lee before the war, got a medal from the Mayor of Hackney. He dragged people from burning buildings on two separate occasions before the First World War. And during the war, he's going out to no man's land rescuing wounded comrades. But, you know, these are people that we've got snippets of history about, knowledge about. This was happening day after day in the Somme, you know. Yeah. And, you know, all I can say is that such was the reaction to my book, They Took the Lead, which, again, BBC London was so good to let me speak about the other year.
Remember, yep.
And what Phil's done with his research, that we're going back next year. I've got four coaches booked, three hotels booked, and we're going over there again, and it's going to give us a chance also to visit the memorial to Walter Toll.
Can you do me a favour, Steve-O? I can't ask for your number on air. When you come off air, speak to Caroline, the producer, leave me a number, because there's a friend of mine called Steve Lyle at the BBC TV. He made a programme about black footballers in the 19th century and into the 20th century, and he won an award for it quite correctly. He's my top producer. Him and I are going out to the Ricky Hatton fight to do some filming in a few weeks' time. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to get him on the case here, and we might even be on the coach. And by the way, Steve, do you know Phil?
No, I don't, but I'd love to get to know him, certainly.
No problem. Can I give Phil your number as well?
Of course you can. An email address. I'll give it to Caroline afterwards.
You're a top banana. Steve Jenkins, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you very much. I tell you what, it gets it moving, it gets it shaking. Now let's get down to the nuts and bolts, as they like to say in Tinseltown, Phil Bowen. I don't mean the posher parts of Hackney when I say Tinseltown. You know where I mean. Where are we with the move?
Well, we've got Noel Clarke has agreed to play Toll. We've got a producer and an executive producer. We're trying to find the right director for it, because obviously it's someone who's really got to empathise with the story and bring out the kind of Walter's inner self, really, because there were a lot of documents left behind about Walter, but there are no love letters of Walter, so it's hard to know what kind of his true inner feelings. Yeah, so...
Sorry, Phil, for interrupting, but perhaps if he was, you know, dragged out and stuck in that orphanage when he was younger, perhaps he, you know, he didn't let people know how he was genuinely feeling and how he was genuinely, you know, what sort of state of mind he was in.
I think that's right, Steve, because in a way, I think he'd been let down emotionally a number of times in his life through no fault of people around him. And, you know, his mother died, his father died, he was moved away from his family.
And a long
his
way
brother
on.
Left, yeah, 70 yeah. miles away. Then his brother left the orphanage. So each stage, in his kind of formative years, he had these emotional upheavals in his life, and I think it had an effect. And I think from reading, you know, in between the lines, I think he found it difficult then to actually give himself to somebody, in a sense of emotionally let himself go, because it was a chance of getting hurt again, you know. Yeah. So, but in terms of the film, there's obviously at the moment we're the producer, executive producer Virginia Green is in talks with some finances about funding it. So that's where we are, really.
You know who I'd get, and I really mean this, and I mean it. You're gonna think I'm being nuts. And the reason why I'm going to say this is his wife's about to make a film about boxing and a real rags-to-riches boxing story. You know who I'd speak to? Guy Ritchie. I'll tell you for why. Because he'll have empathy with the story. He'll love the story. He'll go out to France. He'll cry his eyes out. Plus, he brings a big name to it. And it's a slight shift for him, a slight change for him. I care. It could be the film that restores him. He's only made one movie of any note. The other half a dozen have been absolute garbage. He would love this, I'm telling you.
Steve, if you get Guy Ritchie, you can co-star in it. How's that?
Oh, shoot, can you imagine that? I'd do very well playing Victorians, funnily enough. Phil Vasili, thanks very much for coming in. It's a great story. Walter Toll, look it up. Go Google him. Go and have a look. Go and find out about him. It's a cracking yarn. And I will keep you up to date with this over the next few months. As soon as Phil gets a break, he's going to speak to me again. We had Steve on earlier on. I'm going to definitely get some film with him. Phil, do me a favour. Leave your number with Caroline as well. You've been listening to Steve Bunce talking to Phil Vasili, who is desperate. Trying to put together a story of one of Britain's most remarkable footballers, the first black outfield first division player. He was an officer in the army and he was killed 1915 1916, Phil?
1918,
second battle of the Somme, and people have been calling up saying they've been out to see the sights. well, not the sights, to be able to see where he died. Phil Vasili, thanks very much indeed. Jonathan Beck, fantastic work down there at the Henry Compton School. Sammy and Celine, well done. And a history teacher, Dan Linden. I tell you what, Dambo, terrific gear.